Succession number 28704, reel number 4.
So you just got into crew training.
Well, yeah, the operational training as a crew. That was the first operational training unit in Palestine. That was the first time that we got together. I don't know whether I explained to you, but unlike the services, we weren't ordered or selected to go with certain people. What happened was we were all gathered there in a body. Pilots, navigators, bomb aimers, flight engineers, gunners. And we were told, right, form your own crew. So it was just like a marketplace. You know, people moved around and obviously trying to get in contact with the man who was going to be the pilot, and you know, do you want two gunners and this navigator? He would, you know, so that was how it was done. It was all done in a very informal basis, and gradually that everybody got so sorted out one way or the other, and they formed the crew: pilot, navigator, flight engineer, bomb aimer, gunners, etc.
So and once you were a crew, you stayed together.
Well, yes, we did. We had an exception. We lost our navigator for some reason. I can't remember why. So we got another navigator. Yes, but that set it for the tour of operations. We did our training for as I say, at a Kier. We were on Wellingtons then, Wellington bombers. And we all did our own particular training there, night flying and one thing and another. And as a gunner, we were to do gunnery exercises, and when the pilot was doing what we call circuit and bumps, we just simply sat in the turret. I think on other occasions what they did was they put in a couple of sandbags. I don't know why, whether that was to make up the weight or not, I'm not quite sure. But we just sat there, and but other times we did our own exercise, firing at targets.
What sort of armaments did it with that?
Armaments was the .303. The turret carried 4.303s, and that was our armament on there. And of course, the Wellington, of course, only had the one turret, so we changed places from time to time in order to get experience.
What sort of rate of fire did it have?
I think it's about 600. I think it's a maximum of about 1,200 altogether. You know, because firing four, you know, the guns are firing four lots. You see.
Mm. So was it a four-man crew?
The crew in the Wellington. The crew of the Wellington, because we were getting ready for liberators: pilot, flight engineer, navigator, bomb aimer, wireless operator, mid upper gunner, and the rear gunner. So that was a total crew that we put together. When we finished that training, we moved back down to the canal zone again. To convert to liberators. That was an American aircraft. That was what the Americans called the B-24, mm-hmm. But they were known in the RAF as the Liberator. We called them that. And we did about a 4-week conversion course on the Abbotsweir, down in the canal zone. And then after that, we moved over to Italy.
So what did you think about the Liberator compared to a British plane?
The Wellington had a very good reputation, you know, because of its structure, its makeup, you know, it's sort of what we call the trellis work. It had a reputation of being a very good aircraft, and it could take plenty of punishment. But, of course, it was very limited. There was only two engines compared to the four engines on the Liberator. So I had no real actual experience, flying in active service with the Wellington. But I felt it was a very comfortable plane, a bit cramped, of course. But I had no real problems with it. It was a very safe aircraft.
What sort of range did it have?
Miles. I don't really know, quite frankly. But all I can say is that the Wellingtons were there in Italy when we got there, and they were flying to the same targets as we were, but then they had to change over because the range they had was obviously not good enough, you know, to go to the furthest targets, and they probably weren't carrying as good a bomb load there.
So what sort of bomb load did the Liberators carry?
It was a mixed bomb load. It was either incendiaries or certain weight of bombs, which I think we can find from that photograph there. We can look at that and find out you know, what the load was there. I don't know where you want to break on that. I'm looking at this picture of Verona Railway Bridge, and it gives us the bomb load here. 2 by 1,000 pounds and 10 by 500 pounds.
And the had two turrets on it, didn't it?
Mid upper and rear. Hmm. Yeah.
And they were fitted with.
They were .5s. They were much heavier, a much superior gun to the 303. They fired about 600. I think it's about 600 rounds a minute. Something of that order, but a very much more powerful weapon than the 303. The 303 even, I think some people regard them as rather inferior, not the penetrating power, for 0.5.
What part of Italy were you stationed in?
When on operations?
Yes.
We were stationed in Italy at Foggia, down south, and we were operating Yugoslavia, Austria, Hungary, did a trip to Hungary, and Northern Italy.
So quite a way.
Well, yeah, the longest one was Hungary. I always remember the name of one of the Zombatelli, that was about the furthest one we did, actually. That was quite a way, really.
Did it get very cold in the...
No, but the only thing reason it got cold was because somebody had the bright idea that in order to improve our visibility, they would take the main pane of glass out from the turret, the main one you look out at straight. Somebody had the theory that at night specks on a pane of glass would appear to be fighters or some other object, you see, and they thought that by removing this pane of glass that this would give the gunner a much clearer view. All it did was made him feel burnt, make him cold in the wrong places as well, but what you do is that so you're flying the height that gives you the height there as well, gives you some idea of the height. That's 11,000 feet, and of course you have to have heated clothing. Now I know that the popular conception when you see it in a film is that the heavy fur jacket and this, but in reality, as far as our aircraft, the Liberator, was concerned, what we had was a heated suit, something like like a workman's overall, but only brown. And what happened was you plug that into the system, the heating system, and as long as the engines kept turning, you could get your heat. And also you had a pair of slippers, with studs on the back, and they plugged into the suit as well. You see, so that kept your feet warm. You had I had about three pairs of gloves. I had three pairs of gloves, a woolen pair. A silk pair with a woolen pair over the top of that, and the actual gauntlets, the big big gloves itself. But I mean, with the heating, it kept you really, really warm, at high altitudes, and it's absolutely necessary. And of course, you also have to be wearing an oxygen mask. You have to wear that over a certain height, because the atmosphere is rarefied up once you get up. And we had your throat microphone. Again, not the one you see in the films. You've got the chap over the mouth. But the American one was a throat microphone with two studs that fitted in either side of the throat here, you see. And that's what we used to communicate, all around the plane. But and of course the flying helmet and the boots. The fur-lined boots as well, but all in all, yes, there was no problem as far as keeping warm was concerned. I think that had been well and truly taken care of.
There's a problem if you needed a wee, then.
The problem.
If you needed a wee.
Well, you just didn't have one.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you just didn't have one. I mean, you just seem to be able to last out the trip there and back again. And I think if you ever got to a desperate stage, I mean, well, you had just nowhere to go. I mean, but I never encountered that problem at all. That's a question I never thought I'd be asked. The situation never arose, actually. The thing about Liberator is it's a bigger plane, and it's an interesting one because it's got a very long, thin wingspan.
Is that where the fuel was stored? In the
wings? It's all around there. And the bomb bays, were really separated the plane fore and aft. Up front in the Liberator, you had this one compartment that housed the pilot, the flight engineer, the radio operator, navigator, he was up front a bit, and the bomb aimer, and the mid-upper gunner, they were all in the front, they were all in that front compartment. And then as you move towards the back of the plane, that's where the bomb bays were. So what happened was that to get from fore to aft in the plane, you had to walk through a very narrow gangplank, metal gangplank. So virtually the Liberator was in three sections. Front piece, empty space, you know, for the bomb bay bombs. And what happened was that, you know, the doors went up like that, and that allowed the bombs to drop. And then you came aft, where there was a position for a beam gunner. You know, there's an opening port on either side. And then at the very tail end, you know, was the rear gunner. We didn't always carry a beam gunner with us, but so you could say that I had the whole of the back end to myself.
So you were the tail gunner?
I was the tail gunner, yeah.
Did you feel isolated down there?
I think I just accepted it, you know, and yeah, it's a bit lonely. I mean, you know, because when the plane takes off, you retreat to your little place down there. You know, you're absolutely on your own. You get into the turret, and that's that. You just sit there, and and that's it. Period. Just getting there and all that. Everybody else is up front, and you're away down there, and your communication is through your intercom, you know, with the pilot and the rest of the crew. And any message that have to be passed over the intercom, and that's it.
And did you have a nice crew? I mean, they were good bunch.
Yeah, we were a mixed bag. We had the pilot was an Australian, the other guys were English, and funny enough, the two guns were both Scots chaps. Myself and my he came from Edinburgh, and I came from Millerside, Kilmarnock. So we were a mixed bag, yeah. But we got on all right, no problem. The Australian, he had his friends, you know, from Australia there. There was about half a dozen of them pilots, and they tend to keep together. They kept together really, you know, off duty.
You didn't socialise as a crew.
Well, yes, we did. We went and leave together. when we had a leave coming up, we all went down to Sorrento together as a crew. That was always because, you know, you flew, did so many operations together, you know, you weren't going to split up then. So, yeah, we all went down to Sorrento together, and we all stayed in the same place, and we spent a leave there, and yeah, there was no problem at all, actually. Yeah.
How did you find the Italians towards you?
Well, the Italians, we didn't really have very much contact with them because they kept themselves to themselves. We were stationed at Foggia, which is down south of Italy, we were off duty, went into town there, but. We kept ourselves to ourselves virtually. We had no contact with the Italians. I think the Italians, some of them were a bit sort of resentful. You know, we had been enemies after all, so I don't think they'd quite go over it. But in my experience, we had no what I would call social contact with them at all. We merely just drank their wine, and that was about it. And But there was no social contact with families, people. We had no real common ground for meeting with them.
What squadron were you in then? What squadron were you in when you were
I was in two squadrons. I was in 178 and 37 squadron.
And was it all RAF, or did you have Americans in with you?
We had we shared the airspace with the Americans. The American they were there with thereabouts. With their, you know, they had B-24s as well and the Flying Fortresses. But we very rarely got together. There was nothing. Again, there was I think about only but one occasion where we had them over at our place. But there was, again, there was no. No getting together with the Americans. They kept.
What did you think of them as flyers?
Well, not really. But I think what struck me about the Americans any time that we were there was that they seemed to be well organized and well equipped. You know, you got the impression that. You know, they were spending money on, you know, what they really needed. You know, they always seem to have, you know, good equipment, and the setup always seemed to be well organized. We shared one time we had to, in the transit camp, we had to actually stay with the Americans. That was only briefly for about 3 or 4 days, but I mean, we had access to their food. And
that was good.
Their food was good. their food was good. But we had no real contact with them. You know, it wasn't a question of being buddy-buddy with them or anything like that. They kept very much themselves. And I think at that time we would begin to get the feeling that, you know, the Brits were becoming the junior partner in the war. You know,
when was this? 1940?
This is 44 and 40. Yeah, we got the impression that... you know, somehow we were becoming the junior partners one way or the other. I don't know if that's actually true or not, because our lads took place in the fighting alongside them in one thing or another. But just generally speaking, for example, in Poggio, they virtually ran the town in the sense that they policed it in bigger numbers. I mean, their military police were there. And our fellows were alongside them, and our military police were there. But you always felt that the Americans were in command. For example, if they needed to sort of close down a bar or you know, clear the blokes out of a bar, I mean, you could bet your boots that the American police were in there first of all, and. Yeah, they could be quite heavy-handed too. I mean, if they wanted you out, you were left in absolutely no impression that you would have to go. And
they had jurisdiction over you as well.
Yeah, well, I think they shared it with the British military police were there, but as I say, one felt that the Americans were really running it in that sense. And but anything. I can tell you one incident about it. What happened was that we went downtown to one night in Foggia, and some places were out of bounds and not always clearly defined. So anyway, you know, my usual story, we had a few drinks, and after that we thought, well, we'd like something to eat. Well, you know, that's a problem, because you know, it's not like, you know, going to a holiday resort nowadays. So we kind of scoured around, and we found one little place. I don't know how they could do it, but they could almost produce egg and chips for some reason or another. I don't know where they got the eggs from, but anyway, we had a look around some of the streets and disappeared up this side street, and we found this little place and went in, and you know, said that, you know, want something to eat, and egg and chips, and we had a bottle of wine with us. We'd taken a bottle of wine in with us. So he never said anything. We just went away, and we sat there, you know, waiting patiently for our meal to be served. And the next minute, what happened was, the door burst open, and in came a squad of police. You know, American and Brits came in there, and we were out of bounds. and out, just like that, out. You know, and when we were, you know, we were all NCOs, but rank, you know, no respect for rank, out of bounds, get out. So most of us decided, well, that was the thing to do, you know, because knowing their reputation. But unfortunately, one of the lads I was with, funny enough, a fella Scott, I was walking out the door with a bottle of wine, and one of them, one of the police said, you know, come on, right, I'll take that. He took it right off me. Anyway, my friend, he wanted to stand his ground and argue with him. So without much more to do, they just simply got him by the scruff of the neck, took him outside and dumped him in the truck and took him round to the local lockup. And there he was, you know, for the rest of the evening and till the next day, you know, appeared. And of course, he was on a charge. Well, now that charge was handled by our CEO. They handed them over to him. And he was charged out of bounds and one thing or another, and having a bottle of wine or something. And there on the table as we went in, we were witnesses, and as we went in to before the old man, there was a bottle of wine sitting on the table as evidence of what had been going on. And anyway, I can't remember what he got. He didn't get very much anyway. I think they treated him quite leaning. But the point of that is that, you know, the Americans were leading the show there. They come in, they gave the others get out. They took him off to the local jail or lockup, whatever they had. But then they handed them over to the British. And the British and then handed him another case over to our CEO. And our CEO had, you know, we dealt with the matter there and then.
Were you actually staying on the base, or were you billeted out in families' homes?
No, we were always in camp. Mm. And I have to say, to be quite honest, that Italy in the winter time is not particularly pleasant, especially when you're living in tents. We had no other accommodation than tents. And Italy can be a very cold place in the winter, even in the south. I mean, forget about the Mediterranean image. I mean, the place it was, I think it was a bit of an orchard or something, and the place was absolutely churned up. You know, bad weather and that, and the circumstances were. And so, what they did to keep us warm, they gave us a ration of oil, some mixture of oil, and we built a little fire out of half a barrel or something, and this oil dropped onto the hot plate. That was the secret of it, and you got the fire going, and that was your means of heating. And by Jove, you didn't need it. We used to joke about dressing up to go to bed. I mean, it could be quite cold there.
How many did you have in a tent?
Sorry?
How many did you have in a tent?
Four in the tent. And
were you with other crew members in your tent?
Yeah, one was. I think others were. If I remember, somebody wasn't. But basically, the crew members. And
did the pilots have other accommodation?
Well, the pilot, he had his tent with his friends. I mean, I don't know what the officers.
Were you all flight sergeants then?
Sergeants and flight sergeants and warrant officers. Yeah, that was it. And the other ranks, they had the same. They were just the accommodation was tents. So that was really how we survived there, because as I say, it really was bitterly cold, actually.
How often did you have to go out on operations?
Well, we were pretty regular on operations. I don't have a logbook, you know, but we were fairly constant. What happened was that every morning, each morning, you would go down to the flight tent. That was like an administration point, and they would post up what was called the battle order, and you know, it was you would see whether your name was on it, which it always was. I mean, you know, you'd see one officer Kelly and crew, and that would tell you and give you instructions when to report to the briefing and all that. So you check that every morning to see if you were flying and at what time, etc., etc. And that's the first thing you did. Then you know, you knew where you were for the day. So what happened after that? You know, the time was fixed for the briefing. You know, you got your gear together and it trotted down to the. That was the one thing they did have. Had a hut. That was one thing. That's when they didn't have a hut. And everybody all gathered out there and waited, doors open, then you go, everybody piled in, and the first thing you did was you looked straight down the room, because that was the map, and you could see where the flight was. You know, they had the black, they had the red, I should say, tape, you know, from our base, Podger, you know, to wherever it was. So that gave you right away, you knew where you were going that evening. It was always an evening. No, that's not true, not really. We did some supply drops during the day, but on a bombing trip it was usually an evening takeoff. So what happens is, it's been well documented in the films, is that the usual drill is that the intelligence officer tells you what the target is and why, and you know, any other information, you know, whether a night fighter's operating. If there is a night fighter's operating, they usually have it in a black square round about the target, and that's, you know, that. Fortunately, towards the end of the war, as far as we were concerned, the Germans were a bit light in that fighter aircraft, which is really, to be honest, a good thing for us, because I think, generally speaking, I think the night fighter put more terror into people than anti-aircraft fire is a different thing. Somehow you feel it's, well, okay, you can get through it. I can tell you about that later. But anyway, so anyway, you're prepared for that, and the target, and everything, and the weather, and you know, it's sort of discussed. Everybody being satisfied, as it were, you then get outside, get onto your truck, and they take you out to the actual aerodrome itself, and all you do is you get out, sit by your aircraft, and, you know, kill a bit of time. And then the pilot says, right, okay, you know, time to go, and you climb, and everybody gets up their appointed positions. I always took off in the front of the aircraft, and only when we took off then I would go down the back. And
just in case you had a faulty takeoff, I guess.
Sorry?
In case you had a faulty takeoff and the turret hit.
No, everything was okay.
No, but if you did, you would be very vulnerable, wouldn't you, in the turret?
Yeah, well, you're supposed to test their guns, etc., if there was any problems. Mm. We did take off once when something went wrong with the engines, and the pilot, we were on a supply drop, actually, I remember that one, and we took off, and something had gone wrong with the engines, and so that meant that we had to turn back. Well, we hadn't gone very far, actually, but in order to lighten the load down to a safety margin, we had to circle round about for a certain length of time, and opened up. Well, we had to drop the parachutes as well, the containers and the parachutes. No doubt some local Italians were extremely grateful for that. But I always remember the bombing saying to the pilot, I had him over the intercom, saying, well, you have to be careful here, Skipper, you know, about turning back. You know what you're like. You know what they're like. What he meant was that if you turn back and the reason is not valid, what they can do to you, they'll stamp LMF across your documents, which is lack of moral fibre, you see, and you know, and that's that, and they, you know, that's you're out, that follows you through your career. Anyway, our pilot very sharply said to the bomber, I'm the pilot here, I will make the decision. You know, he established his authority right away. He said, I will, you know, I'm making a decision, you know, we're going back in again. And, you know, silence after that, which was quite right, that's the way it should have been. Anyway, we went back in again, and the pilot gave his reason, and nothing more was said about it. It was accepted. But it was the fact, somehow, that the bomb member had more or less challenged his authority, and our skipper would not have it. And, you know, we're talking about people in the crew who are all around about early 20s, you know, but the pilot was, in my opinion, was mature enough, you know, to deal with the situation, you know, was not going to be overruled, you know, by anyone else.
Who were you going to supply then?
The partisans, the Yugoslav partisans.
Yes.
Yeah. The Yugoslav partisans.
So that was quite a journey for you.
That wasn't too bad because Yugoslavia was just over the water, as it were, from Italy.
So how far were you back from the main line of the battle line, as it were?
Well, the main battle line in